Matthew's? Or was it something else entirely, something I haven't yet guessed at? Whatever the reason, it seems strange that Carol should get Edward so wrong. Of course, she never met him. She's relying on what Emma told her. Which in turn suggests that Emma was also mistaken about him. Or, another thought occurs to me, that Emma herself deliberately misled her therapist. But why should she do that? I get out my phone and find a number.
Hampstead Homes and Properties,
Camilla's voice answers. Camilla, it's Jane Cavendish. A short pause while she places me.
Jane, of course. Is everything all right?
It's fine, I assure her. It's just that I found some things in the attic here that I think might have belonged to Emma Matthews. Would you have any contact details for the man she moved in here with, Simon Wakefield? Camilla sounds guarded.
I take it you've learned about Emma's accident, then. That was when we took over, actually. The previous agents lost the contract after the inquest, so I wouldn't have any details for tenants before then.
Who was the previous agent?
Mark Howarth, of Howarth and Stubbs. I can text you his number.
Thanks. Something makes me add, Camilla, you say your agency started letting 1 Fulgate Street 3 years ago. How many tenants have lived here since then?
Besides you?
2.
But when you showed me round, you told me it had been empty for almost a year. That's right. The first tenant was a nurse. She only lasted 2 weeks. The second managed 3 months. I found a month's rent stuffed through our door one morning, and a note saying if she stayed there a day longer, she thought she'd go crazy.
They were both women, I say slowly.
Yes, why?
Doesn't that strike you as odd?
Not really. I mean, no more than anything else about the house. But I'm glad you're all right.
She leaves the words dangling, as if inviting me to contradict them. I don't say anything.
Well, bye then, Jane.
Then, Emma. He leaves reluctantly, the Swain Adeney bag waiting on the stone table while we have one last breakfast. It won't be for long, he says, and I'll come back for a night or two when I can. He takes a final look around the house, at the pale open spaces. I'll be thinking of you, he says. He points at me, wearing that, living like this, the way the house was meant to be lived in. I'm wearing one of his white Comme des Garçons shirts and a pair of his black boxer shorts as I eat my toast. Though I say it myself, it works. Minimal house, minimal clothes. I'm becoming a little bit obsessed with you, Emma, he adds. Only a little. Perhaps the break will do us good. Why? Don't you want to be obsessed by me? His eyes go to my neck, to my new shorter haircut, almost too short for his hands to get a grip in when he fucks me. My obsessions are never healthy, he says quietly. After he's gone, I open my computer. Time to find out more about the mysterious Mr. Monkford. The fact is, the way he reacted last night when he saw my haircut has given me an idea. An idea so crazy I can hardly believe it myself. Mr. Ellis, I call. Tom Ellis? At the sound of my voice, a man turns toward me. He's wearing a suit, a yellow hard hat, and a frown of disapproval. This is a construction site, he says. You can't come in here. My name's Emma Matthews. Your office said you'd be here. I just want a quick word, that's all. What about? Barry, I'll catch you later, he says to the man he was talking to. The man nods and heads back into one of the half-finished buildings. Edward Monkford. He stiffens. What about him? I'm trying to find out what happened to his wife, I say. You see, I think it could happen to me as well.
That gets his attention all right. He takes me to a cafe near the site, an old-fashioned greasy spoon where construction workers in high-vis jackets tuck into plates of fried eggs and beans. Tracking down the fourth member of the original Monkford partnership hadn't been easy. Eventually, I'd found an old cutting online from Architects Journal, announcing the partnership's formation. Four fresh-faced graduates stared out confidently from a fuzzy black-and-white photograph. Even back then, it was clear Edward was their natural leader. Arms folded, face impassive, he was flanked by Elizabeth on one side and a ponytailed, much slimmer David Teal on the other. Tom Ellis was to the right of the picture, a little separate from the others, the only one smiling for the camera. He brings us mugs of tea from the counter and spoons two sugars into his. Although I know the Architect's Journal photo was taken less than a decade ago, he looks quite different now. Heavier, fatter, his hair thinning. "I don't normally talk about Edward Monkford," he says. "Or the rest of the partnership, for that matter."
"I know," I say. "I could hardly find anything online. That's why I phoned your office. Though I must admit, I hadn't expected to find you working for somewhere like Town and Vale Construction."
Tom Ellis's employer is a massive company that builds estates of near-identical houses for commuters.
"Edward's trained you well, I see," he says dryly.
"What do you mean?" "Town and Vale build affordable homes for people who want to bring up families. They site them near transport links, schools, doctor's offices and pubs. The houses have gardens for children to play in and insulation to keep fuel bills down. They might not win architectural prizes, but people are happy in them. What's wrong with that?"
"So you had a difference of opinion with Edward," I say. "Was that why you left the partnership?"
After a moment, Tom Ellis shakes his head. "He forced me out," he says.
"How?"
"In a thousand different ways. Challenging everything I suggested, ridiculing my ideas. It was bad enough before Elizabeth died, but after he came back from his sabbatical and she wasn't there to rein him in anymore, he turned into a monster."
"He was heartbroken," I say.
"Heartbroken," he repeats. "Of course. That's the great myth Edward Monkford spun around himself, isn't it? The tormented genius who lost the love of his life and became an arch minimalist as a result."
"You don't think that's right?"
"I know it isn't." Tom Ellis studies me as if debating whether or not to go on. "Edward would have designed his barren little cells right from the start if we'd let him," he says at last. "It was Elizabeth who held him back. With her and me backing each other up, he was effectively outnumbered. There was David Teal, of course. He only cared about the engineering side. Elizabeth and I, though, we were close. We saw things the same way. The partnership's early designs reflected that."
"How do you mean, close?"
"Close enough. That is, I suppose I was in love with her." Tom Ellis glances at me. "You look a bit like her, actually. But I suppose you already know that." I nod. "I never told Elizabeth how I felt," he says. "At least not until it was too late. I thought it might be difficult if she didn't feel the same way, given we were working together so closely. That didn't stop Edward, of course."
"If Edward wanted her, he'd have told her so," I say.
"The only reason he made a play for Elizabeth was to take her away from me," Tom Ellis says flatly. "It was all about power and control, just as it always is with Edward. By making her fall in love with him, he gained an ally, and I lost one."
I frown. "You think it was about the buildings? You think he married her just to make sure the partnership built the kind of houses he wanted?"
"I know it sounds crazy," Tom Ellis says, "but Edward Monkford is crazy, in a way.
No one's that ruthless."
He laughs hollowly. "You don't know the half of it."
"But the first house the partnership built, 1 Folgate Street, was originally going to be quite different," I object.
"Yes, but only because Elizabeth got pregnant. That hadn't been part of Edward's plan at all.
Suddenly she wanted a family home with two bedrooms and a garden. Doors to shut off rooms for privacy instead of flowing open-plan spaces. They argued about it. God, how they argued. To meet her, you'd think Elizabeth was a sweet, gentle soul. But she was just as stubborn as him in her own way. An extraordinary woman. He hesitates. One night, not long before Max was born, I found her in the office, crying. She told me she couldn't bear to go home to him, that they were so unhappy together. He was incapable of the smallest compromise, she said. Tom Ellis's eyes drift away from me, unseeing. I put my arms around her, he says. I kissed her. She stopped me. She was completely honorable. She'd never have done anything behind Edward's back. But she told me she had a decision to make. Whether to leave him, you mean? He shrugs. The next day she said I should forget what had happened, that it was just the hormones making her upset. That Edward might be difficult, but she was committed to making their marriage work. She must have managed to get him to compromise to some extent, because the final designs were actually quite good. No, more than good. The house was brilliant. It made perfect use of the available space. It wouldn't have won any awards, it probably wouldn't even have put the partnership on the international map. Comfortable, well-thought-out architecture never does. But the three of them would have been happy there. He pauses. Edward had other ideas, though. In what way? Do you know how she died? He asks quietly. I shake my head. Elizabeth and Max were killed when a parked digger rolled into a stack of concrete blocks near where they were standing. At the inquest, it was suggested that the blocks hadn't been stacked correctly and the pile was unstable. Plus, the digger might have been parked on a slope with its handbrake off. I spoke to the site foreman. He told me the stack was sound and the digger parked correctly when he left the site on Friday afternoon. The accident happened the next day. Where was Edward? On the other side of the site, checking progress, or so he said at the inquest. And the foreman? Did he speak out? He watered his evidence down, said there'd been squatters sleeping on the site who might have broken into the digger. Edward was still employing him, after all. Can you remember the man's name? John Watts, of Watts and Sons. It's a family firm. So, let me be clear about this, I say. You believe Edward killed his family just because they were getting in the way of the kind of house he wanted to build? I say it as if I think Tom Ellis is crazy, as if the idea is so preposterous I can't believe it. But actually I can. That is, I know Edward's capable of anything that he decides to do. You say just, Ellis says flatly. There is no just with Edward Monkford. Nothing's more important to him than getting his own way. Oh, I don't doubt he loved Elizabeth, after his own fashion, but I don't think he cared for her, if you see what I mean. Did you know there's a species of shark so vicious their embryos eat one another in the womb? As soon as they develop their first teeth, they turn on one another until only the biggest one's left, and that's the one that gets born. Edward's like that. He can't help himself. To challenge him is to be destroyed by him. Did you tell the police any of this? Tom Ellis's eyes look haunted. No, he admits. Why not? After the inquest, Edward went away. Later we heard he was living in Japan. He wasn't even working as an architect, just supporting himself with odd jobs. David and I thought we'd seen the last of him. But he came back, I say. Eventually, yes. One day he walked into the office as if nothing had happened and announced that from now on the partnership would be going in a new direction. He cleverly pitched it to David as a fusion of visual simplicity and new technology and persuaded him that I was standing in the way. It was his revenge on me for taking Elizabeth's side against him. So while he was away, I say, you didn't want any scandal because you thought the partnership was all yours. That's why you kept quiet. Tom Ellis shrugs. That's one interpretation. It sounds to me as if you were trying to piggyback off Edward's talent. Think what you like. But I agreed to talk to you because you said you were scared. I didn't say I was scared. I'm curious about him. That's all. Christ. You're in love with him too, aren't you? Tom Ellis says, sourly staring at me. I don't know how he does it. How he mesmerizes women like you. Even when I tell you he killed his own wife and child, you aren't disgusted. It's almost like it excites you, makes you think he really is some kind of genius, when all he really is a baby shark in the womb.
Now, Jane. It takes a bit more detective work to track down Simon Wakefield. I managed to speak to Mark, the agent who dealt with 1 Folgate Street before Camilla, but he doesn't know how to contact Emma's former boyfriend either. If you do speak to him, though, he says, give him my best, will you? It was tough what happened to him. Emma's death, you mean? That too, but even before then, with the break-in at their previous flat and so on. They were burgled? I didn't know that. That was why they wanted 1 Folgate Street in the first place, for the security. He pauses. Ironic when you think about it, but Simon would have done anything for Emma. He wasn't particularly keen on living there himself, but as soon as she said she liked it, that was that. The police asked me if I'd ever seen any evidence he could be violent toward her. I told them no way. He adored her. It takes me a moment to understand what he's saying. Hang on. The police thought Simon might have killed her. Well, they didn't say so explicitly, but I had to liaise with them after she died, letting the forensics teams into the house and so on, so I got to know the detective running the investigation quite well. He was the one who asked about Simon. Apparently, Emma had claimed he'd physically hurt her. He lowers his voice. I was never really sure about Emma, to be honest. Everything was all about her, if you know what I mean. Bit of a drama queen. It seemed like Simon didn't get much say in things. Mark might not have his contact details, but he remembers where Simon worked, and that's enough information for me to track him down on LinkedIn. The magazine he wrote for has closed now, and like most freelancers, he keeps his profile and CV publicly searchable. Even so, I hesitate before contacting him. Yes, he might have left flowers for Emma outside 1 Folgate Street, but from what Mark just told me, Simon had also been a suspect in her death. How sensible is it, really, to start questioning him about what happened? I will be careful, I decide, and make sure I don't press or threaten him in any way. So far as he's concerned, I'll simply be trying to make amends for taking his floral tributes. I send a bland email asking if we can meet for a chat. A reply comes back within minutes, suggesting Costa Coffee in Hendon. I'm early, but he is too. He arrives dressed much as he was that time outside 1 Folgate Street, polo shirt, chinos, trendy shoes, the smart casual uniform of the London media worker. He has a pleasant, open face, but his eyes are troubled as he takes a seat opposite me, as if he knows this is going to be difficult. So, you got curious, he says, once we've introduced ourselves properly. I'm not surprised. Confused, more like. Everyone I speak to seems to have a different version of how Emma died. Her therapist, for example, she thinks Emma killed herself because she was suffering from depression. I decide to come right out with it. And I also heard some story that the police questioned you because of an allegation Emma had made. What was that all about?
I don't know. That is, I've no idea why she said it, or even if she really did.
I would never, ever have hit her. He looks me in the eye, emphasizing every word. I worshipped the ground Emma walked on.
I've come here today warning myself to be cautious, not to take everything this man says at face value. But even so, I believe him. Tell me about her, I suggest. Simon exhales slowly.
What can you say about someone you love?
I was lucky to have her. I always knew that. She went to a private girls' school, then a proper college, and she was beautiful, really beautiful. She was always getting approached by scouts for model agencies. He glances at me a little sheepishly. You look a bit like her, by the way.
So I've been told.
But you don't have a... He frowns, trying to find the right word, and I sense he's probably trying to be tactful.
Vibrancy. It caused her all sorts of problems, actually. She was so friendly. Men always felt they could approach her without getting brushed off. I told the police the only times Emma saw me so much as threatened violence was when some idiot wouldn't leave her alone. Then she'd give me a look, and that was my signal to step in and tell the guy to back off.
So why would she say that you hit her?
I really don't know. At the time, I thought the police made it up to rattle me, to make me think they had more on me than they really did. To be fair to them, they apologized and let me go quite quickly. I think they were just going through the motions, really. Most murders are committed by someone close to the victim, aren't they? So they bring in the ex-boyfriend as a matter of course.
He's silent for a moment.
Except they got the wrong ex. I kept telling them it was Edward Monkford they should be looking at, not me.
I feel the hairs on the back of my neck prickle at the mention of Edward's name.
Why's that?
Conveniently enough, Monkford wasn't around much in the aftermath of Emma's death. He was away, working on some big commission. But I'll never accept it wasn't him who killed her.
Why would he do that?
Because she'd broken up with him.
He leans forward, his gaze intense.
About a week before she died, she told me she'd made a terrible mistake, that she'd realized he was just a manipulative bully, a control freak. She said, and I suppose this is ironic, really, given how much he hated her to have any possessions of her own, that he treated her like an accessory. Just one more thing to make his house look pretty. He couldn't stand her having any thoughts or independence of her own.
But no one murders someone just for having their own thoughts, I object.
Emma said that over time he changed completely. When she called it off, he became almost deranged.
I try to imagine a deranged Edward. Yes, there have been times I've sensed passion underneath that preternatural calm. A maelstrom of emotions reined tightly in. His anger with the fishmonger, for example. But it's only ever lasted a few moments. I just don't recognize the picture Simon's painting.
And there's something else. Simon's saying, something that might be another reason for him to want Emma dead.
I bring my attention back to him.
Go on.
Emma found out that he murdered his wife and their baby son.
What? I say, confused. How?
His wife stood up to him. She made him compromise his plans for One Folgate Street. Defiance and independence again. For whatever reason, Edward Monkford is pathologically unable to cope with either.
Did you tell the police all this?
Of course. They said there was insufficient evidence to reopen the investigation. They also warned me against repeating my accusations at Emma's inquest. They said it could be libel. In other words, they decided to ignore it.
He rakes his hand through his hair. I've been doing a bit of digging myself ever since, gathering what evidence I can. but even as a journalist, it's hard to get far without the kind of powers the police have. Just for a moment, I feel a wave of sympathy for Simon. A perfectly nice, solid, unexciting guy, unable to believe his luck when he'd snagged a girl a bit out of his league. And then a series of unforeseen events had happened, and suddenly she was faced with choosing between him and Edward Monkford. There really wouldn't have been any contest. No wonder he found it impossible to move on. No wonder he had to believe there was some hidden conspiracy or secret behind her death. "We'd have ended up back together if she hadn't died," he adds. "I'm absolutely certain of it. Sure, the way we broke up was messy. There was this one time she wanted me to sign some papers. I went to the house to try and win her around, but I was a bit drunk and I didn't handle it very well. I think I was jealous of Monkford even then, so I knew I had a lot of work to do to make it up to her. The first step was convincing her to move out of that horrible house, and she'd agreed, in principle anyway. There were issues with the lease, some kind of cancellation penalty. If she'd only managed to leave, I think she might be alive today. The house isn't horrible. I'm sorry you lost Emma, but you really can't blame it on one Folgate Street. One day, you'll see I'm right. Simon looks directly at me. Has he made his move on you yet? What do you mean? I protest. Monkford. Sooner or later, he'll make a pass at you. That's if he hasn't already. And then he'll brainwash you too. That's what he does. Something. Perhaps knowing that if I admit we're lovers, it'll simply confirm Simon's belief that women fall over themselves for Edward, makes me say, "What makes you think I'd say yes?" He nods. "Good. Well, if me talking about Emma's death saves just one person from that bastard's clutches, it'll have been worth it." The cafe's filling up. A man sits down at the next table, clutching a sausage and onion toasty. A pungent reek of cheap, dank dough and overcooked onions wafts toward us. "God, that sandwich smells disgusting," I say. Simon frowns. "I can't smell it. So, what are you going to do next?" "Is there any chance Emma could have been exaggerating, do you think? It still seems odd to me that she made such bizarre claims to you about Edward Monkford and equally bizarre claims to the police about you." I hesitate. Someone I spoke to described her as a person who liked being the center of attention. Sometimes people like that need to feel they're important in some way, even if it means making things up. He shakes his head. "It's true Emma liked to feel special, but she was special. I think that was one reason she liked One Folgate Street. It wasn't just the security. It was because it was so different. But if you're saying that made her some kind of fantasist, no way." He sounds annoyed. "Okay," I say quickly, "forget it." "Is it all right if I sit here?" A woman holding a sub points to the empty chair next to us. Simon nods reluctantly. I get the impression he'd like to go on talking about Emma all day. As the woman sits down, I catch the nauseating smell of fried mushrooms. It smells like wet dogs and dirty bedsheets. "The food here really is disgusting," I say in an undertone. "I don't know how anyone eats it." He gives me an irritated look. "You'd rather have met somewhere more upmarket, I suppose. That's more your style." "It's not that." I make a mental note that Simon Wakefield has a bit of a chip on his shoulder. "I like Costas normally. This one seems unusually smelly, that's all."
"It doesn't bother me."
Nauseous, I stand, eager to get into the fresh air. "Well,
Thanks for meeting me, Simon.
He stands too. Sure. Look, here's my card. Will you get in touch if you find out anything else? And give me your own number, just in case.
In case of what?
In case I finally get some evidence that Edward Monkford really is a killer, he says evenly. If I do, I'd like to be able to let you know. Back at 1 Folgate Street, I go up to the bathroom and undress in front of the mirror. When I touch my breasts, they feel sore and full. My nipples have darkened perceptibly, and there are little raised spots like goosebumps around each areola. My period isn't due for a week, so a test won't be reliable. But I don't really need one. The heightened sensitivity to smells, the nausea, the darkened nipples, the little raised bumps my midwife told me were called Montgomery tubercles. It's exactly what happened the last time I was pregnant.
9. I get upset when things don't go as planned. Agree or disagree?
Then, Emma. It's been a while since I saw you, Emma, Carol says. Yes, I've been busy, I say, pulling my legs up underneath me on her sofa. When we last spoke, you'd recently asked Simon to leave the house you shared, and we talked about how survivors of sexual trauma often find themselves contemplating big changes as part of their process of recovery. How have those changes been working out for you? She means, have you changed your mind about Simon yet, of course. For all she swears her job isn't to make judgments or direct our sessions toward any particular conclusion, I'm coming to realize that Carol often does exactly that. Well, I say, I'm in a new relationship. A pause. And is that going well? It's with the man who designed the house, 1 Folgate Street. He's a breath of fresh air after Simon, to be honest. Carol raises her eyebrows. And why is that, do you think? Simon's a boy. Edward's a man. And you haven't had any of the sexual problems you experienced with Simon? I smile. Definitely not. After a pause, I add, there is something I'd like to talk to you about, though. Something specific. Of course, she says. I must hesitate, because she adds, there's nothing you can tell me that I won't have heard many times before, Emma. I find myself thinking about being overpowered, I say. I see, she says carefully, and it excites you? I suppose it does, yes, but also troubles you. I just find it strange, after what happened. Shouldn't it be the opposite? Well, the first thing to say is that there's no should or shouldn't, she begins, and it's actually not that uncommon. Among the general population, around a third of women say they regularly engage in fantasy scenarios involving power transference. Plus, there's a physical aspect too, she adds, what's sometimes called excitation transfer. Once you've experienced adrenaline in a sexual situation, your brain may unconsciously seek more of it. The point is, it's nothing to be ashamed of. It doesn't mean you'd enjoy it in real life. Far from it. I don't feel ashamed, I say. And I do enjoy it in real life. Carol blinks. You've been acting out these ideas. I nod. With Edward? I nod again. Would you like to tell me about it? Despite her claim about being non-judgmental, Carol looks so uncomfortable that I find myself embellishing a little, just to shock her. It's a funny thing, I conclude, but making him angry makes me feel more powerful, somehow. You certainly seem more assertive today, Emma, more confident in your choices. The question I'm asking myself is whether these are healthy choices for you just at the moment. I pretend to think about that. They probably are, I decide. Clearly, this isn't the answer Carol was hoping her carefully phrased question would receive. The choice of partner when you're experimenting is very important, she says. Actually, I wouldn't call them experiments, I say, more like discoveries. But if it's all so wonderful, Emma, she says quietly, why are you here? Good question, I think. We've talked before about how survivors of rape can sometimes, wrongly, blame themselves, she adds. How they can feel they're the ones who deserve to be punished, or that they're somehow worth less than other people. I can't help wondering if that's partly what's going on here. She says it so sincerely that for a moment I almost crumble. What if I was never raped, though, I say. What if it was all a kind of fantasy? She frowns. I'm not following you, Emma. Nothing. But suppose I found something out about somebody, about a crime they'd committed. If I told you, would you have to tell the police? If the crime hadn't yet been reported, or if it was reported but your evidence might make a difference to the investigation, then the situation is complex, she says. As you know, therapists have a professional code of ethics that includes confidentiality, but we also have to uphold the law. In a conflict between the two, the law takes priority. I'm silent, thinking through the implications. What's troubling you, Emma? She prompts gently. Really, it's nothing, I say, flashing her a smile.
Now, Jane. A blood test at my GP's office confirms it. I tell no one yet, except for Mia, Beth, and Tessa. Mia's first question, of course, is, was it planned? I shake my head. Edward got a bit carried away one night. Mr. Control carried away? I'm not sure whether I should be worried or relieved he's human after all. It was a one-off. We had words about it afterward, actually. I know Mia will think I mean about the lack of contraception. I don't go into details. Does he know? Not yet. The truth is, I'm not sure how Edward is going to feel about this. Mia's ahead of me. Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't no children one of the rules? The house rules, yes, but this is hardly the same. Is it? She raises an eyebrow. We all know how men love unplanned pregnancies. I don't say anything. And you? She adds. How do you feel, Jay? Scared, I admit. Terrified. Because despite the whirligig of emotions, disbelief, joy, anxiety, euphoria, amazement, renewed grief for Isabel, happiness, when it all comes to a stop, the one I'm left with is sheer, naked fear. I couldn't go through that again. If something happened to this one, that misery, I just couldn't. It would break me. They said at the time there was no reason your next baby shouldn't be perfectly healthy, she reminds me. There was no reason last time either. It still happened. But you are going to keep it, right? There are very few people in the world who could ask me that question, and even fewer to whom I would give an honest answer. That part of me has been saying, don't. You're back in the light after so long in a dark and lonely place. Why roll those dice again? It's the same part of my brain that looks around One Folgate Street and thinks, why jeopardize all this? But there's another part of me, the part that has held a dead baby in her arms, that gazed down on her perfect face and felt the ecstatic joy of motherhood just the same, that could never even consider aborting a healthy fetus because of my own cowardice. Yes, I'm going to keep it, I say. I'm going to have this baby, Edward's baby. I know he won't like the idea at first,
but I'm hoping he'll get used to it.
Then, Emma. When I haven't heard from Edward in 2 weeks, I sent him a selfie. I got a tattoo, Daddy. Do you like it? The reaction is instant. What have you done? I know I should have asked your permission first, but I wanted to see what would happen if I was really, really bad. In truth, the tattoo is small, quite pretty, and invisible when wearing normal clothes. A stylized representation of a seagull's wings, just above the swell of the right buttock. But I know how much Edward loathes them. P.S. It's quite sore. The reply comes a few minutes later. And going to get sorer. Tonight, I'm coming back to London. Angry. It's the longest text he's ever sent me. I smile as I send my reply. I'd better get ready then. I take a shower, drying myself carefully, dabbing the tiniest amount of perfume on my skin. I wear the dress and the pearl collar but leave my feet bare. Already my skin is tingling. The feeling of anticipation is delicious, but it's mingled with nervous excitement. Have I pushed him too far? Can I handle what he's going to do to me? I arrange myself on the sofa. Eventually, I hear the faint beep from housekeeper as it senses someone at the front door, then a ping as it grants him access. He strides toward me, his face dark. Show me, he snarls. I barely have time to turn around before he's grabbed both my wrists with one hand and bent me over the sofa, almost ripping the dress as he pulls it up with the other. He freezes. What the? I start to laugh uncontrollably. He shakes my wrists angrily. What in God's name are you playing at? It was Amanda's, I manage to gasp. She got a tattoo to celebrate splitting up with her husband. I went along to the tattooists with her. You sent me a picture of someone else's ass, he says slowly. I nod, still helpless with laughter. I cancelled a dinner with the mayor and the regional planning committee to come back here tonight, he growls. Well, which is going to be more fun, I say, wiggling my buttocks at him invitingly. He doesn't let go of my wrists. I'm furious with you, he says wonderingly. You've deliberately made me angry. You deserve every bit of what you're about to get. I pull away to test his grip, but he has me tightly. Welcome home, Daddy, I sigh happily. Later, much later, before he leaves, I give him a letter. Don't read it now, I say. Read it when you're alone. Think about it when you're in your boring planning meetings. You don't have to reply, but I wanted to explain myself to you.
Now, Jane. My first maternity appointment. Opposite me, across an ugly NHS desk, sits Dr. Gifford. A few days ago, I got a computer-generated letter explaining that, although there was no reason to be concerned, my medical history meant my pregnancy had automatically been graded as higher risk. I would therefore be under the care of a specialist, Dr. Gifford. Someone obviously realized their mistake, because later the same day, I got a call saying they completely understood that I'd want to see a different doctor. I might in any case be aware that Dr. Gifford had tendered his resignation. They say pregnancy muddles your thinking. So far, I've found the opposite. Or perhaps it's simply that some decisions become easier to make. Finally, I know what the right course of action is. The thing is, I tell him, I don't think you should have to resign because of something that wasn't your fault. And we both know your replacement will be just as overworked as you are. He nods warily. So here's my proposal. I suggest we work together to put pressure on the hospital. I'll write to them saying I don't want them to make Isabel's death a formal SUI,
but I do want reassurance they're going to increase staffing levels and introduce more Doppler scans. If you tell them those are also your conditions for withdrawing your resignation, the chances are they'll see the opportunity to make a deal. How does that sound? It hadn't sounded great to Tessa, who would rather have gone for the formal investigation and the big solution. But I'd stood firm, and eventually she'd come around. Is she always like this? She'd asked Mia ruefully. Before Isabel, she was, Mia replied, smiling at me, the most organized, stubborn, think-through-every-last-detail person I know. I think we finally have the old Jane back. Dr. Gifford isn't totally convinced either, at first. At a time of scarce resources, he begins cautiously. At a time of scarce resources, it's more important than ever to fight your corner, I interrupt. You know as well as I do that scans and more doctors will save more lives than some expensive new cancer drug. All I'm doing is helping your department get its voice heard. He nods. Thank you. And now you'd better examine me, I say. If I'm going to be under your care, I may as well make the most of it. The examination is thorough, much more thorough than the one I had at this stage with Isabel. I know I'm getting special treatment because of what Dr. Gifford and I have been through together. But that's fine. I no longer consider myself one of the herd, an average person. The size and position of the uterus are good. A pap smear is taken to test for cervical cancer and a tissue sample to test for STDs. I'm not concerned. There is absolutely no chance that the fanatically fastidious Edward could have an untreated STD. My blood pressure is good. Everything is in order. Dr. Gifford says he's pleased. I've always been good at exams, I joke. While I'm lying there, I tell him about the birth I'd wanted with Isabel, a water birth with diptyque candles and music. He tells me there's no medical reason why that shouldn't happen this time. Then we talk about supplements. Folic acid, obviously, he suggests 800 micrograms. Vitamin D is also advisable. Avoid multivitamins that might contain vitamin A, but consider vitamin C, calcium, and iron. Of course I will take those. All of them. I'm not the kind of person who can ignore a guideline or leave undone anything, however small, that might help. I get the necessary pills on the way back to the house, double-checking the labels to make sure no vitamin A has crept in by mistake. The first thing I do after hanging up my coat is to go to my laptop to see what other dietary changes I should be thinking about. Jane, please score the following statements on a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 is strongly agree and 5 is strongly disagree. Some house facilities have been disabled until the assignment is completed. I stop dead. It seems to me these metric tests have been more frequent since Edward's been away, almost as if he's checking up on me, making sure I'm still calm and serene and living according to the rules all the way from his distant site office. More to the point, I would have typed pregnancy recommended diet into housekeeper without thinking if it hadn't been disabled. I must remember to use the neighbor's Wi-Fi for everything now, at least until I've told Edward. And also, I think, until I know what really happened to Emma. Because the two, the revealing to Edward of my secret and the prizing open of his own secrets, are connected now. And it's a lot more urgent than it was. For my baby's sake, I have to know the truth.
Then, Emma. Detective Inspector Clark calls me into the station for yet another chat. The process of the law is clearly speeding up, because he takes me not to his cubbyhole of an office, but to a large, well-lit meeting room. There are 5 people ranged down one side of the table. One's in uniform. I get the impression he's quite high up. Next to him is a petite woman wearing a dark suit. Then comes John Broom, the CPS lawyer from the bail hearing, and Sergeant Willen, my support officer, who sits with a space between her and the others, as if to indicate that she's not senior enough to take any real part in this. D.I. Clark, who up to now has been his usual cheery self, indicates that I should sit opposite the petite woman and places himself on the far side of Sergeant Willen. There's a jug of water and a glass in front of me, but, I notice, no biscuits and no coffee. No Garfield mugs today. "Thank you for coming, Emma," the woman says. "I'm Specialist Prosecutor Patricia Shapton, and this is Chief Superintendent Peter Robertson." The big guns. "Hello," I say, waving at them. "I'm Emma." Patricia Shapton smiles politely and continues. "We're here to talk about Dion Nelson's defense to your allegations of rape and aggravated burglary. As you probably know, it's a requirement these days for the prosecution and defense to share information before the trial, to prevent cases coming to court unnecessarily." I hadn't known, but I nod anyway. "Dion Nelson is claiming misidentification," she goes on. She takes a document from the pile in front of her and puts on some reading glasses. Then she peers at me over the top of the glasses, as if waiting for me to respond. "I didn't see him at the bail hearing," I say quickly. "There are several witnesses who say you did. But that's not the specific issue we're here to discuss." For some reason, I'm not relieved to hear this. Something about her tone and the silent, watchful faces of the others is making me uneasy. The atmosphere has turned serious, aggressive even. "Dion Nelson has provided medical evidence, intimate medical evidence, that he cannot be the man who recorded himself receiving oral sex from you," Shapton says. "The evidence is compelling. In fact, I'd go so far as to say it's incontrovertible." I feel a sense of vertigo that swiftly turns to nausea. "I don't understand," I say. "From a legal standpoint, of course, that's all his defense needs to do to secure an acquittal," she continues as if I hadn't spoken. She picks up some more documents. "But, in fact, they've gone considerably further. These are sworn statements from some of your colleagues at Flowwater Supplies. The most relevant for our purposes is the one from Saul Axoy, in which he describes a recent sexual relationship with you, during the course of which, he says, at your request, the two of you made a video fitting the description of the one Detective Inspector Clark found on your phone. There's that phrase, 'I wanted the ground to swallow me up.' It doesn't begin to describe what happens when your whole world implodes, when all the lies you've told suddenly come crashing down around your ears." There's a long, horrible pause. I can feel tears stinging my eyes. I fight them back. I know Patricia Shapton will think they're just a ruse to get sympathy. I manage to say, "What about the other phones you found? You said Dion Nelson had done this before. He's hardly innocent." It's Chief Superintendent Robertson who answers. "It used to be thought there was a link between committing burglary and watching hardcore pornography," he says, "because burglars often had unusually large collections of explicit DVDs. Then someone realized that burglars just hung on to the pornography they found in other people's houses. Nelson did the same with phones. He kept the ones with sexual images. That's all." Patricia Shapton takes off her glasses and folds them up. "Did Dion Nelson force you to give him oral sex, Emma?" There is a long, long silence. "No," I whisper. "Why did you tell the police that he did?" "You asked me in front of Simon," I explode. The tears do come now, tears of self-pity and anger, although I keep talking, desperate for them to understand, to see that this is their fault just as much as mine. I point at Sergeant Willen and D.I. Clark. They said they'd found the video and it looked like Nelson forcing me, I say. They said you couldn't see his face or the knife. What was I supposed to do? Tell Simon I'd had sex with someone else? You accused a man of raping you at knife point and of threatening to send obscene images of that attack to your family and friends. You kept up the deception when your story was challenged. You even read a victim personal statement in court. D.I. Clark made me, I say. I tried to back out, but he wouldn't let me. Anyway, Nelson deserved it. He's a thief. He stole my stuff. The words, so pathetic and petty, hang in the air. I catch sight of D.I. Clark's face. Written across it is a whole library of emotions. Contempt, pity, and anger. Anger that he's allowed himself to be deceived by me, that I've exploited his desire to protect me by piling lie on lie on lie. There's another awful silence. Patricia Shapton glances at Chief Superintendent Robertson. Clearly this is some prearranged signal because he says, "Do you have a lawyer, Emma?" I shake my head. There's the man who drew up the deed of variation when Simon moved out, but I don't think he'd be much use in this situation. Emma, I'm going to arrest you now. It means you can have access to a duty lawyer later, when we question you about this formally. I stare at him. What do you mean? We take cases of rape very seriously. That means assuming every woman who says she's been raped is telling the truth. The flip side is that we take false rape allegations equally seriously. On the basis of what we've heard today, we have enough evidence to arrest you on suspicion of wasting police time and attempting to pervert the course of justice. You're going to arrest me? I go, disbelieving. What about Nelson? He's the criminal. We'll have to drop the charges against Dion Nelson, Patricia Shapton says. All of them. Your evidence is totally discredited now. But he stole my things. No one's disputing that, are they? Yes, actually, Chief Superintendent Robertson says. Dion Nelson claims he bought the phones from a man in a pub. We may not believe him, but in evidential terms, there's absolutely nothing tying him to you.
But you can't think.
Emma Matthews, I'm arresting you on suspicion of attempting to pervert the course of justice and wasting police time contrary to Section 5.2 of the Criminal Law Act, 1967. You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defense if you do not mention when questioned something which you later rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence. Do you understand?
I can't speak.
Emma, I need you to answer. Do you understand the nature of the allegations against you?
Yes,
I whisper. After that, there's a numb sense of having stepped through a looking glass. Suddenly, I'm not the victim anymore, to be treated with kid gloves and sympathy and brought mugs of coffee. Suddenly, I'm in a different part of the station altogether, where the lights have metal cages over them and the floors stink of vomit and bleach. A custody officer looks down at me from a raised platform behind a desk and explains my rights. I empty my pockets. I'm handed a copy of the custody code of practice and told I'll be given a hot meal if I'm still here at supper time. My shoes are taken away and I'm escorted to a cell. There's a bed built into one wall and a short shelf on the opposite side. Otherwise, it's completely empty. The walls are white, the floor grey, the light diffused through the ceiling. The thought occurs to me that Edward would be quite at home here, but of course he wouldn't really. It's grimy and smelly and uncomfortable and cheap. I wait 3 hours for a duty lawyer. At some point, the custody officer brings me a copy of my charge sheet. Written down, it looks even bleaker than it sounded upstairs. I try not to think about the expression on D.I. Clark's face as I left the room. The anger was gone, leaving only disgust. He'd believed in me, and I'd let him down. Eventually, a plump young man with gelled hair and an overlarge Windsor knot in his tie is shown in. He stands in the doorway and shakes my hand over an armful of files. Graham Keating, he says. I'm afraid the lawyers' rooms are all in use. We'll have to talk in here. We sit side by side on the hard bed, like two shy students who can't quite get it on, and he asks me to say in my own words what happened. Even to my ears, it sounds feeble. What will happen to me? I say when I'm done. It really depends on whether they go down the time-wasting route or the perverting the course of justice route, he says. If it's the former, and you plead guilty, you could be looking at community service or a suspended sentence. If it's the latter, well, there's no limit on the sentence a judge can impose. The maximum's life imprisonment. Obviously, that's only for very extreme cases, but I should warn you, it's a crime judges do tend to take seriously. I start to cry again. Graham delves into his briefcase and finds a pack of travel tissues. The gesture makes me think of Carol, which in turn reminds me of another problem. They won't be able to question my therapist, will they? I say. What sort of therapist are we talking about? I started seeing a psychotherapist after I was burgled. It was the police who suggested her. And you've told this therapist the truth? No, I say miserably. I see, he says, although he's plainly baffled. Well, as long as we don't introduce state of mind, there's no reason for them to involve her. He's silent a moment, which does rather bring us to what our defense is going to be, or rather our mitigation. I mean, you've already told the police what happened, but you haven't really said why. What do you mean? Context is everything in RASOs, rape and serious sexual offences. And because these charges originated with an allegation of rape, they'll continue to be handled under RASO regulations. Sometimes I've acted for women who felt pressured or bullied into making or withdrawing an allegation, for example. That helps a lot. That didn't... I begin, then stop. You mean being frightened of someone might get me off? Not completely, but it might dramatically reduce the sentence. But I was frightened, I say. I was frightened of telling Simon. He's violent sometimes. Right, Graham says. He doesn't say, now we're in business, but that's his body language as he flips open a yellow pad and prepares to make notes. What sort of violence?
Now, Jane. D.I. Clark. The man in the brown windbreaker nursing half a pint of beer looks up.
That's me, although I'm not a D.I. anymore. Just plain Mr. James, if you prefer.
He stands up to shake my hand. At his feet is a grocery bag full of fruit and vegetables. He gestures at the bar.
Can I get you a drink?
I'll get myself one. It's good of you to meet me.
Oh, it's no bother. I come into town anyway on a Wednesday, for the market.
I get myself a ginger ale and go back to join him. I'm amazed by how easy it is to track people down these days. A phone call to Scotland Yard had established that Detective Inspector Clark had retired, which felt like a setback, but simply typing, "How do I find a retired police officer?" into a search engine, not housekeeper, of course, had thrown up an organization called NARPO, the National Association of Retired Police Officers. There was a contact form, so I sent them my request. A reply came back the same day. They couldn't give out members' details, but they'd forward my question on. The man sitting opposite me doesn't look old enough to be retired. He must guess what I'm thinking because he says,
I was 25 years in the police game. Long enough to take my pension, but I haven't stopped work completely. Me and another ex-detective have a little business installing security alarms. Nothing too pressured, but it's tidy money. You want to talk about Emma Matthews, I understand.
I nod. Please.
You're a relative?
He's clearly noted the resemblance. Not exactly. I'm the current tenant at 1 Folgate Street. At first glance, James Clark seems like a solid, ordinary bloke. The kind of working man made comfortable who might own a small villa in Portugal beside a golf course. But now I see that his eyes are shrewd and confident.
What exactly do you want to know?
I know Emma made some sort of allegation against her former boyfriend, Simon. Not long afterward, she was dead. I've heard conflicting explanations as to who or what killed her. Depression, Simon, even the man she went on to have a relationship with. I deliberately don't mention Edward's name, in case Clark picks up on my interest in him. I'm just trying to shed some light on what happened. Living there, it's hard not to be curious.
Emma Matthews pulled the wool over my eyes, D.I. Clark says flatly. That didn't happen to me often as a detective. Almost never, in fact. But there I was, faced with this plausible young woman who said she'd been too scared to report a really unpleasant sexual attack. I wanted to do something for her. Plus, we were under pressure at the time to get rape convictions up. I thought with the evidence we had, for once I'd actually be able to please my bosses, get justice for a victim, and put a nasty piece of trash called Dion Nelson away for a long time into the bargain. Triple whammy. Turned out I was wrong on all three counts. She told us